Thank you, everyone, for joining the teleclass, Disinfectants in Infection Control, Can They Make Bacteria Resistant to Antibiotics? My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, and a sponsor for this teleclass, Virox Technologies, I'd like to welcome you, particularly if this is your first teleclass experience. In order to keep teleclass registration fees low and in order to make teleclass education available for free to those healthcare professionals in developing nations, we're pleased to have the support of some really, really great companies. Today, I'm really pleased to announce that this teleclass is being sponsored by Virox Technologies, Inc. These guys have been great supporters of teleclass education right from day one, and it's my pleasure to be able to thank them again. Randy Pilon, thank you very much. Our faculty today is a man tremendously dedicated to letting people know about disinfection, so much so that he's stayed late in his office and he's using his own cellular phone to join us on this teleclass today. Today we're joined by the very popular Dr. Peter Gilbert. Dr. Gilbert is professor of microbial physiology at the School of Pharmacy and Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of Manchester in England. To present the teleclass, Disinfectants in Infection Control, Can They Make Bacteria Resistant to Antibiotics? I give you Dr. Peter Gilbert.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Paul. What I'm briefed to talk to you about today is really a cost-benefit, a risk-benefit analysis for the use of disinfectants in the home and in hospital. The benefit clearly is that it reduces the risk of infection and therefore reduces the use of antibiotics. The risk might be that our overuse of disinfectants and antiseptics might actually make bacteria resistant to those antibiotics and therefore contribute to the whole problem of multiple antibiotic resistance. So if we move on to the first slide, this is essentially an overview of what I'm trying to cover today. I intend to start off by looking a little bit about how we find bacteria in their natural setting. In other words, how are they actually exposed to biocide? And as we'll learn, this is predominantly as biofilms. I then want to go on to look at the way in which bacteria respond to biocidal treatments in biofilm. I want to look a little bit at biocide action resistance mechanism, and then go on to the real crux of this talk, which is looking to how misuse of biocides could possibly lead to antibiotic resistance. So I'm on to slide 3, and it's worth stressing that nowadays we do not view bacteria as growing planktonically. Rather, we see their natural lifestyle as biofilms growing attached to surfaces. In this respect, the last 20 years of research has shown that biofilms are the normal mode of growth of bacteria. Attached to surfaces, bacteria become enveloped in extracellular slimes, which may be comprised of polysaccharide or glycopeptide. But those slimes hold the organism to the surface and also hold the organisms in close proximity to one another so that they can actually cooperate with one another in terms of their mechanism of growth. It's worth noting that biofilm bacteria are physiologically distinct from the same organisms growing in planktonic culture. Biofilms themselves in infection are often monocultures, but when we look to the environment in which we use disinfectants and antiseptics, we have a great phenotypic and genotypic heterogeneity represented. So these are mixed community systems. It's not bacterial monocultures. So let's move on to looking at bacteria in their domestic setting. Most of us, when we wake up in the morning, if we look in the bathroom mirror and move our tongue over our teeth, we'll find that those teeth are nicely smooth and slimy. That slime actually is a bacterial biofilm. So first thing in the morning, overnight, we have grown a vast population of bacteria. In the mouth, we have up to 600 different taxa of bacteria represented. The slide represents the sorts of spatial organizations that we see within plant bacteria. You'll notice that there are cocci attached around the edges of Fusobacter. These are functional consortia, where the cocci generate an anaerobic environment within which the Fusobacters can survive. This is a functional consortia biofilm. Let's move on and look at the skin. We might regard the skin as being a relatively bacteria-free environment, but in reality, the skin is colonized by large numbers of bacteria. If we look at this slide, and we're looking here down a sweat gland, we see that there are clusters of bacteria colored yellow. If you look at the numbers of organisms found in these clusters, you can see that they're there in fours and eights. In essence, the bacteria have attached and subsequently grown and divided. These organisms feed off the sweat that comes through the skin. They derive their nutrient from it. They are growing quite happily as biofilms. Let's move on, because these biofilms are not harmless. In many instances, they can actually lead to infection. We think of biofilms as being very problematic. Certainly, they can foul pipework. They can corrode copper pipes. They can act as a source of contamination of prepared foods. They're responsible for many incidences of cross-infection associated with the hospital and infections related to implanted medical devices and so forth. Biofilms are usually regarded as something we want to get rid of. And this brings us on to what is probably the biggest single problem about biofilms. Next slide. The biggest problem about biofilms is their resistance. If you look to the literature generated in the last 15 years, you'll find reports suggest biofilm bacteria are anything between 50 and 1,000 times less susceptible to antibacterials and antibiotics. This resistance is displayed across a whole range of different chemical entities. So we see resistance with antibiotics, biocides, preservatives, and antibacterials. There is no commonality in mechanism or chemical structure for these agents, and that really adds to the problem, the enigma of biocide resistance in biofilms. Let's move to the next slide. In order to consider whether exposure of biofilms to biocides could lead to multiply resistant organisms, then we have to consider what makes the biofilms resistant in the first place. And we really have three schools of thought on resistance. The first of these relates to restricted access of antimicrobial. This is the sort of intuitive explanation of resistance in biofilm communities. When we see a visible biofilm that's several hundred microns thick, it's very easy to think that antibiotic and biocide will not penetrate across it. So this sort of diffusion or restricted access was the first real explanation of why biofilms are resistant to antimicrobials. The second explanation, which I'll deal with a little bit more in a second, relates to the physiological status of the cells within a biofilm. As we will learn, both of these mechanisms have their problems in terms of being universal explanations of biofilm resistance. So we actually have to look to the phenotypic heterogeneity within these communities as our explanation of the biofilm resistance phenomenon. So let's quickly go through these resistance mechanisms. So let's think about reaction diffusion limitation. Here, essentially, the antimicrobial is exposed to the outer face of the biofilm, and in order to kill cells that are found deep within its core, then it must diffuse through the matrix to eventually reach cells that are down at the base. Now, for antimicrobials that are cationic, these agents will bind to anionic binding sites within the slime matrix, and therefore their diffusion will be impaired. For oxidizing biocides, such as peroxides and halogens, then you'll actually have a chemical reaction taking place between the antimicrobial and the matrix, and this will consume the antimicrobial properties of the treatment agent. So what we're doing is quenching the agent within that outer field. The problem with this sort of resistance mechanism is that as soon as all the binding sites have been saturated by your antimicrobial, or as soon as the reactive capability of the matrix has been consumed by your oxidizing agent, then essentially diffusion will proceed, and eventually cells that are deep down in the core will succumb to the antimicrobial treatment. We also have a problem in that reaction diffusion limitation will only explain resistance to strongly charged antimicrobials and ones that are chemically highly reactive. We have a whole range of antibiotics which do not fulfill either of those criteria. In this respect, people have invoked the properties of various enzymes, because bacteria living within a biofilm produce enzymes that are deposited within the matrix and bound within it. So if an organism produces, for example, a beta-lactamase antibiotic, this becomes trapped within the intracellular matrix, and therefore as the antibiotic attempts to diffuse past it, it is denatured. Now, as a resistance mechanism, this is a stronger argument than reaction diffusion limitation by binding, because the enzymes theoretically act as catalysts, and therefore they themselves are not consumed in the reaction. If we think of enzymes such as catalase, we might imagine that that would destroy hydrogen peroxide and peroxide-generating biocides. Equally, things like aldehyde lyase and aldehyde dehydrogenase can explain the resistance to many aldehyde biocides such as formaldehyde and glutaraldehyde. So enzyme-assisted penetration failure can again explain resistance, but you actually have to have the enzymes there in the first place. If the enzymes aren't there, then you're not going to actually generate resistance to an antimicrobial. So there's a limit to how much we can use enzyme-assisted penetration failure as an explanation of resistance. Penetration failure fails as an explanation of resistance because the agent can essentially quench the sites and eventually organisms will recover down at the base. Sorry, will suffer from the action. We have to turn to physiological gradients to look for a second explanation of biofilm resistance. Now, for many decades, it's been realized that rapidly growing bacteria are much more susceptible to antibiotics and biocides than are stationary phase cells. So this particular explanation relies on the fact that cells at the outer surface of a biofilm are exposed to high nutrient and high oxygen concentrations so that they can actually sustain a high growth rate. These organisms will be sensitive to most antimicrobials. If we go down into the depths of the biofilm, however, we find that the cells down in the depths are starved of nutrient. All of the nutrient penetrating through to them has to pass by these actively metabolizing cells on the surface. So as we go into a biofilm, we find that cells are exposed to low nutrient concentrations. Often the conditions are anoxic. So they favor very low growth rates. And low growth rates universally are related to resistant populations. So an explanation of biofilm resistance was that biofilms harbored cells that were growing extremely slowly. Hopefully you're now looking at a picture of a biofilm with three colored sections to the left-hand side. These pictures were generated by Bill Costerton's group in Montana, and what they represent are various confocal sections through a microscope, through a biofilm. And as we look to the insets to the left-hand side of the slide, we can see at the top a micrograph illustrating respiration. In the center, we look at alkaline phosphatase activity. And towards the bottom, we're actually seeing the distribution of ribosomes within a biofilm community. Hopefully, what you can see is that to the outer surface of these biofilms, we have highly metabolically active cells with a good level of respiration on the outer surface. If you look to the middle, we'll see that there's a gradient of alkaline phosphatase expression. And if we look to the bottom, we see that cells are clearly growing much, much faster on the outer surface, as indicated by the high density of ribosomes. I'm still in the same slide. We will see that those cells that are slow growing and have low metabolic activity on the inner face will appear to be resistant to treatments, whereas those that are on the outer face, because of their high metabolic activity, will be sensitive. This sets up the whole explanation of biofilm resistance. I'm now moving to the next slide. What we believe is that gradients of antimicrobial generated through a biofilm community and the physiological gradients of growth rate together conspire to make the cells that are on the outside of a biofilm die first, and the cells on the inside of a biofilm to die last. These two mechanisms, though, even though they've been subject to 20 years of research in the, that have been published in the literature, can only delay death. And hopefully the next slide will illustrate this. This slide started off as an animation, but what I'm seeing are four micrographs that represent a time lapse of exposure of a confocal section taken through a biofilm community. And we're looking at treatment with monochloramine, so this is an oxidizing biocide, but regardless of whether we're looking at monochloramine, the actual pictures we see are fairly typical. If we look to the left-hand side, we can see that in the time zero, we have a biofilm that is metabolically active and alive throughout its depths. In the second, the 30-minute exposure, we've had 30 minutes of monochloramine exposure from the bottom of this picture. And what you should be able to see is that there is the cells towards that outer surface have become green in color. The greenness reflects a vital stain. So the cells on the outer surface have died. They've died possibly because they're more sensitive to the agent, possibly because they're the first cells to be reached. As we go through the slide, you'll see that with time, this zone of killing moves from the outside of the biofilm into the depths of the community. So we see more and more death. Now, once again, that could be a reaction diffusion limitation. So as the agent penetrates into the community, it simply reaches more and more cells. And for years, this was used as an explanation or a demonstration of the validity of reaction diffusion limitation. However, it could be, and if I'm now looking at the second from the left image, it could be that as the cells on the outside are killed, then we actually have the cells underneath accelerating in terms of their growth rate. The cells on the outside are no longer consuming nutrients, therefore the cells just under the surface grow faster and in turn become more susceptible to the agent and die. So as we go through, we see that this loss of a physiological gradient causes cells to accelerate in their growth rate and eventually succumb to the agent. So this picture where death comes in from the outside of a biofilm community can be explained either in terms of physiological gradients or in terms of reaction diffusion limitation. I'm clicking on, and just to make sure that everyone is with me on this slide, the slide is headed phenotypic heterogeneity, and to the bottom left of the image it says what are these pockets of survivors. So the image you see is in fact that last slide in that time-lapse image. What I'd like you to see is that even after 2 hours exposure to an oxidizing biocide such as monochloramine, and even though we see that about 99% of the population has been killed, we actually have little pockets of cells that exist in the biofilm community that are alive and metabolically active. I've called these pockets of survivors. Now, these little zones of survival can't relate to reaction diffusion limitation, because they're right on the edges of the biofilm community. They should have been exposed to high levels really very, very quickly. So it can't be that. They shouldn't be slow-growing cells, because they've got ample supplies of nutrients. Yet these are the cells that survive biocidal treatments. When you administer disinfectants in hospitals or on surfaces or onto the skin, then it's these little pockets of survivors that survive one treatment, that grow and divide between it, and go on to cause a resurgence of the infection. As we will come on to later on, there are various explanations as to what these survivor cells relate to. It could be that they are simply random mutations that represent less susceptible clones. It could be that they are efflux mutants, ones that hyper-express multiple efflux drug pumps. Or it could be some sort of response to sub-effective biocidal treatment. Now, I'll come on to discuss these different explanations for why these survivors are there in a minute. But for the moment, let's not worry about that. Let's think what the effects of repeated exposure to antimicrobials might be. I've clicked onto the next slide, and what we see here is potential cycle of resistance development associated with sub-effective dosing. You can imagine treating a very vital biofilm community with antimicrobial. We kill 99.99% of the viable bacteria there, and we're left with these small pockets of survivors that represent some form of less susceptible clone. If we then allow the biofilm community to recover, what we've actually done is to enrich for this less susceptible phenotype. And of course, as disinfection dosing carries on over many, many cycles, we're going through many, many enrichment cycles. And the worry is that this sort of enrichment might actually lead to organisms that are not only less susceptible to a disinfectant, but that might also be cross-resistant to many forms of biocide. I'm now changing tack on the story. You've learned a little bit about resistance in biofilms. Now let's start thinking about the expansion in use of antibacterials. Over the past 10 years, there has been a massive expansion in the use of antibacterial agents. We don't just find antibacterials in hospital, we now find them in all sorts of consumer products on our supermarket shelves. It would be fair to say that we're now drowning in antibacterials. They're being pushed and sold into many applications where before we didn't even realize we needed an antibacterial. In many instances, there is no demonstration of effectiveness and no demonstration of benefit associated with these uses. Now, it's fair to say, or fair to ask the question, that could this overuse of antibacterials in a whole variety of consumer products lead to resistance to the antimicrobial? And more worryingly, could it lead to resistance to third-party antibiotics? So I'm going to ask some questions. And the first one is, can the use and abuse of biocides lead to biocide resistance? And here, I think we actually need to look to history. Biocides have been in use certainly for more than 100 years. They predate antibiotics by about 50 years. What has been recognized over that century is that biocides are a vital contributor to effective hygiene, that they are vital to public health. Over that 100 years of use of biocides, at the moment, there is little evidence, in fact, there's no evidence, that there has been any loss of their effectiveness in hygienic situations. So we've been using antimicrobials for 100 years without loss of effectiveness. Now, why could that be? Next. We have to look to mechanism to find out that. Now, here's a cartoon illustrating mechanism of many of these biocidal molecules we use in infection control. What we see in this cartoon is that as we increase the concentration of the agent from left to right of the slide, what we actually do is to increase the number of vulnerable targets in the cell. These agents are not acting like antibiotics. These agents have a multiplicity of target. At very, very low concentrations, these agents will actually slow growth. Round about the MIC, that's the minimum growth inhibitory concentration, it's possible that only one or two inhibitory targets are implicated in the action of the agent. But by the time we actually get to the point of use, and this is the sort of concentrations that we try and deploy on hard surfaces or on skin, then in fact the concentration is such that at least three or four, possibly a dozen, different mechanisms of killing are brought into play. So at use level, the bacteria suffer a sort of death by multiple wounds. Next slide. We need to make a distinction here. And the distinction we're making is between changes in susceptibility and resistance. Now, susceptibility change is often reported in the literature as a change in the minimum growth inhibitory concentration. Now, at the MIC, these biocides are often only affecting one target. So, in order to change the MIC, all you need is a change in that one target. And that's quite common. You'll often see papers reporting changes in susceptibility of biocides, and the evidence presented is a change in the MIC. And that sort of change in susceptibility is about as common as you see reports of changes in susceptibility towards antibiotics. Now, resistance is a completely different game. Resistance to a biocide implies therapeutic failure. The bacteria no longer respond to in-use levels of the agent. Now, in order to get resistance to biocidal molecules, we actually need to modify all of the potential targets. Now, to modify all the targets is statistically very, very unlikely. So with biocide use, we can see changes in susceptibility reflected in the MIC, but we haven't, over 100 years of use, seen resistance develop. If we look to the harbingers of doom, who are very, very vocal in the media and in the press, and respond to their question, can biocide resistance parallel the development of antibiotic resistance? You've probably all heard people talking about a post-biocide era. So could we be entering one? And the answer is an absolutely emphatic no. Biocides remain as effective now as they were 100 years ago. It is not going to happen. Let's ask the question in a different way, though. The harbingers ask a slightly different question. They ask, can changes in biocide susceptibility, now these are the changes at sub-effective levels that affect the MIC, can these changes affect antibiotic resistance? And here we have to be a little bit more cautious in our answer. Because let's think, I'm now on a slide showing dilution away from point of use. So we might have a biocide that's being deployed at its site, and at the site we have no loss in activity, but we have a whole multiplicity of targets that are being inhibited. Now of course we might use the product on a kitchen bench or on the skin, but eventually that agent is going to get washed away into the environment. So it's going to become diluted away from the point of use. Now if we think of dilution away from the point of use, it could also be dilution into a biofilm community. So as I click on to the next slide, the only thing that's changed is the wording on the arrow, which suggests that we have reduction in concentration as we dissipate a biocide within a biofilm. Now, as we go from the site of application, which might be the outer part of a biofilm, and dilute it as we go in, we actually reduce the number of targets that are being affected. If when we get to the point round about the minimum growth inhibitory concentration, then if at that point the target that causes growth inhibition by the biocide is the same target that an antibiotic uses to kill bacteria, then sharing of targets could possibly bring about a selection of antibiotic resistance. Next slide. So I'm back to my community, and I'm asking, what are these pockets of survivors? What's the probability that these pockets of survivors from a biocide-treated population represent less susceptible clones reflecting modification of the MIC target? And what's the probability that that target is shared with antibiotics? Now, 7 or 8 years ago, we would have said the chances were fairly slim. But if we move on to the next slide, up jumps the agent triclosan. Stuart Levy, a few years ago, realized that triclosan, a very commonly used biocide in consumer products as well as healthcare products, actually inhibits growth of E. coli through inhibition of an enol reductase enzyme responsible for fatty acid synthesis in the cell membrane. Now this growth inhibition is actually the action that is responsible for triclosan having an MIC against E. coli. But what Stuart pointed out was that if you mutated the enol reductase target, and you could actually have spontaneous point mutations in that target, then this would confer resistance to triclosan. It led to organisms that would arise fairly spontaneously that had a radically altered MIC towards triclosan. These mutants are very easily selected in the laboratory at high frequency. So all we're demonstrating is that triclosan, in terms of its growth inhibitory activity, is hitting the enol reductase. Now, is that enol reductase important in any other way? Next slide. We actually find that the enol reductase in mycobacteria is the sole target for the antitubercular drug isoniazid. It's also the target for hexachlorophane and an experimental group of antibiotics called the diazoborines. So the enol reductase is actually shared. So we're left with the possibility that deployment of triclosan, whilst still effective in infection control, could actually be compromising the use of inotiazid in treatment of tuberculosis. Now, this is really worrying, and this has really hit the national press, not just in the States, but also in Europe. The problem is this scaremongering arose 5 or 6 years ago, and what has never hit the press is the small print. The disclaimers. So let's look to the next slide. In the small print, and this is what they never tell us, and this is that isoniazid resistant tuberculosis actually remains susceptible to triclosan. So although both hit the arbovidactase, they're hitting different sites on the same target. What they don't tell us is that these mutants, these Fabi mutants in the enol reductase, can only be selected for in Escherichia coli. If you look to skin bacteria or oral bacteria, and those are the sites where triclosan is most deployed, then you don't see the same selection. What they don't tell us is that triclosan-based molecules are now being developed as a new class of antitubercular drugs. So rather than ending the validity of isoniazid as an antitubercular, triclosan is now being looked to as a starter molecule for new antitubercular treatments. They don't tell us that. Triclosan worried us for some time. You could ask, is triclosan a one-off? Sadly, it's not. There are many other antimicrobials used in infection control. For example, the isothiophilones and phenylethanol are widely used as preservatives and disinfectants. Now, sublethal concentrations of these agents induce filamentation in cells. We don't know how, but you could argue it's a possible pressure on topoisomerases or penicillin binding proteins. In which case, you could ask, do isothiazolones select for penicillin resistance or ciprofloxacin resistance? This next slide actually shows some data that suggests that use of isothiazolones can actually compromise the use of quinolones such as ciprofloxacin. If I was giving a different talk, then I could suggest that these changes in susceptibility towards ciprofloxacin of isothiazolone-exposed cells heralded the end of ciprofloxacin use. The reality is that these are small changes in susceptibility. They are not changes that are sufficient to be regarded as resistance. But certainly the association is made. Polyhexamethylene biguanides and biguanides such as chlorhexidine are used extensively in infection control. All of these agents get into bacteria by a mechanism of self-promoted entry. That mechanism of cell entry is shared by the aminoglycoside antibiotics. So could it be that use of chlorhexidine selects for cells that are deficient in cations in their surface and therefore share resistance or losses of susceptibility to aminoglycosides? We don't know the answer. If you look to the literature, you'll find that over the last 2 or 3 years, there are many publications now that are claiming linkages between disinfectant use and antibiotic resistance. In all of these cases, you will find that when the authors refer to resistance, they are actually referring to a change in MIC. So these changes in resistance don't actually link to therapeutic failure of the biocide. But certainly the scene is set for people to be scared into dismissing hygiene as a danger. So what could these pockets of survivors be? Clearly, if these survivors are multiply resistant to a whole range of agents, then what we need are common mechanisms that are associated with many different types of agent. And a mechanism that has reached the literature quite loudly is that of efflux. Efflux pumps essentially remove antimicrobial from a bacterial cell before it can accumulate inside the cell to toxic levels. You'll certainly see references to multi-drug efflux pumps, and they're often associated with bacteria, or rather superbugs, that are resistant to almost every agent man can throw at them. I'd like to change the way you view efflux mutants. Next slide. Because certainly the way I view efflux pumps is a sort of microbial vomit reflex. Because efflux pumps are turned on whenever bacteria experience adverse conditions. Expression of efflux pumps has certainly been shown to be induced by sublethal exposure to antibiotics such as tetracycline, to sublethal exposure to quaternary ammonium compounds and pine oil disinfectants. Essentially, if the cell is effluxing quaternary ammonium compounds, it will also, at the same time, be effluxing the antibiotic. We have a concern with triclosan that it's a substrate for efflux pumps. So triclosan can be pumped out, but it is not an inducer molecule. So this is something that can be pumped out of a cell but can't actually induce the vomit reflex. If you therefore expose a community to triclosan, you'll select for bacteria that are efflux on. You'll select for bulimic bacteria that cannot actually control their intracellular contents. Now, induction of these pumps or the demonstration of efflux on mutants is actually linked to clinical antibiotic resistance. Now, pump induction can influence susceptibility to biocides, but won't confer resistance. So what we have is a possibility now that with this sort of vomit reflex, exposure of bugs to biocides could actually promote some form of multiple antibiotic resistance. And the worry is that the overuse of hygiene agents could actually add to that selection pressure. Hopefully you're looking now at a picture of four slightly green images. Now, these are wells in agar plates. Now, quite a few years ago, I was concerned about my efflux pump induction, and I sent a graduate student off to the supermarket to purchase various types of household products. And he purchased 53 household products, and we put them into this very simple test. We had an indicator strain of E. coli that had LAC-Z included as part of the MAR operator. What this means is that if the product that is in the center of the well could induce efflux, then you'd see a blue ring around the well. If the product inhibited growth and also induced efflux, then you'd see a zone of no growth followed by a blue ring. Now that's shown best by the image to the top left-hand side of this picture. One showing no inhibition of growth, but efflux is shown best by the bottom left picture. Of the 53 products purchased out of this supermarket, more than half of them induce multiple antibiotic resistance through efflux. That was worrying, but let's look to the next slide, because the next slide actually indicates what these compounds were. You'll notice that the strong inhibitor and inducer was actually chili paste. The thing that didn't inhibit but induce was mustard. All of these products, all of the products that induce MAR were not cleaning agents, they were not hygiene agents, they were common foods and spices. They were things that are naturally at high levels within the environment. So if we start thinking about multi-drug efflux pumps and the effect that use of antibacterials might have on them, we have to remember that they've evolved to contend with natural anti-infectives. They're induced and upregulated in response to many food materials that we have in our kitchens and our homes. I'm particularly happy that that well-known product Sunny Delight actually is probably one of the most potent inducers of multi-antibiotic resistance that we actually know about. To my knowledge, no one is calling for an international withdrawal of Sunny Delight. We have to view these resistance mechanisms in context. Okay, so there is a possible scare. There's a possible linkage between biocide use and resistance. Certainly in the laboratory, you can make such connections. But in the real world, we actually find that those connections don't work. So what's the difference between the real world and the world of the laboratory? Well, in the real world, dealing with microcosms, not monocultures. Now, in a microcosm, you have many different bacteria competing with one another for nutrient. They're competing with one another for space. And essentially, the fittest organism survives. Now, if an organism is modified in order to accommodate a resistance mechanism, then that has implications to its fitness to survive. And the reality appears to be that in microcosms, in mixed culture, the fitness cost associated with resistance actually leads to the elimination of the resistant mutant. We also see that in microcosms, there is a substantial degradation and loss of the biocide, so that its effects diminish with time. Let's look to the literature and see what is actually happening. Since these scares started arising, a number of people have looked to the environment to determine whether or not antibacterial usage has actually stimulated antibiotic resistance. And what they've done is to go into hospital environments, into infections, into intensive care units, into food processing environments where biocides are used regularly and continually. When they survey those organisms and look at their susceptibility to antibacterials and antibiotics, then those surveys have failed to demonstrate any evidence whatsoever that the use of antibiotics the use of antibacterials has even remotely compromised the use of antibiotics. There is absolutely no evidence that the increased use of antibacterials in consumer and hygiene products has affected susceptibility within the environment. Now, we think we explain this in terms of fitness cost. All of the evidence here is summarized in a review that I prepared for Clinical Microbiology Reviews. It was published in July of this year. I understand that review is available to distribution to people listening to this lecture. So hopefully you'll get hold of that and look at the summary of the survey evidence. Let's move on, because you can look to the environment that's been exposed to 50 years and find no evidence. Let's set up laboratory microcosms that duplicate chronic exposure to antimicrobials. We've set up a number here at Manchester. We've set up microcosms that mimic household drains. These systems have been exposed to various antimicrobials over a period of up to 2 years. During that period of time, we have found no change in the antibiotic susceptibility pattern of cells within that community. These papers have been published fairly recently, all in 2003, but certainly we see no evidence in drain. We've had chronic oral models set up looking at chlorhexidine and triclosan, and in no incidence do we actually see an increase in antibiotic resistance. What we see is a reduction in diversity of those communities with an expansion of organisms that were already resistant to the biocide in question. What we find from these microcosm studies is that the effect of the antimicrobial is to control that population but not to develop resistance. If people email me, I'm quite happy to send them copies of these publications because all four are now out in print. Let me just show you one of those studies. This is a study that's attempting to mimic a drain community. We're assuming that any household product containing antibacterial will eventually go down the drain. We're using a constant depth film fermenter to model that community. In this system, these fermenters have been set up over a 5-year period and exposed regularly to antibacterial containing products. We can generate many, many replicates of drain microcosm. What we see on this slide is the actual drain microcosm we generate, and you can see that we produce a bacterial community that's about 5 millimeters deep. It's very heterogeneous, and it contains several hundred different genotypes of microorganism. Hopefully you're looking at some pie charts. This work has been published, I think, last month in Applied and Environmental Microbiology, but it shows the effects of chronic dosing with triclosan over a 1-year period of this drain community. All I hope you take from this is that before dosing, we have a much greater level of complexity in that community than post-dosing. We've simply reduced the number of players in the community by imposing triclosan stress. If we pull the organisms that we isolate post-treatment and look at their antibiotic susceptibility, then we find it's unchanged from the susceptibility they displayed before treatment. So all we've done is kill the susceptible organisms and allow the less susceptible ones to take over their place within the community. We've got a reduction in diversity and no change whatsoever in antibiotic resistance. We don't have to rely on culture to look at this. Hopefully you're looking at a dinitrogen gel gradient electrophoresis pattern. This is produced by non-culture analysis of a community. We actually probe the 16S ribosomal DNA, and we can look at all bacteria present in an environment, regardless of whether we can culture them in the lab. The slide actually shows this reduction in diversity from left to right, and a clonal expansion of pre-existing less susceptible phenotypes. Some of the bugs that are expanded, and we're on to the next slide, actually are responsible for solubilization and degradation of the triclosan. So we're actually creating a triclosan degrading community from this prolonged exposure. So triclosan is actually broken down in our drains, in our environment. It's not a risk. So our microcosm conclusions, and this goes across a range of biocides, is that we don't see the resistance selection that was evident in lab monoculture, that there are fitness costs associated with the generation of monoculture superbugs, and that we see degradation being selected for. So sublethal exposure of communities to biocides does not select for resistance development. So I'm going back to the original question, is the uncontrolled use of biocides in the environment a selection pressure towards antibiotic resistance? And the answer is now a probable no. In fact, I'd go as far as to say a definite no. Has the indiscriminate use of antibacterial products compromised therapeutic solutions to infection? Then there is no in vivo evidence of link. There is no evidence from long-term microcosm studies that that is the case. This is definitely a media scare. So into conclusion, I like to think of this as targeted hygiene ahead with caution. I'm going through some bullet points here. How do we go ahead? I think the use of antibacterials has expanded beyond our imagination. Antibacterials are now being associated with products where there are no demonstrable benefits. Personally, I think that usage should cease. There has to be a demonstrable benefit to justify use. Where we have demonstrable benefit is in good hygienic practice. Because we know that effective infection control will reduce disease, will in turn reduce the use of antibiotics, and that in turn will reduce antibiotic resistance. So we shouldn't abandon good hygienic practices where there's a proven benefit to product or to health. If we're going to use antibacterials, we should use ones that lose their effectiveness rapidly as they dilute from the point of action. They should leave no residual. This really leaves us with things such as bleach and peroxygen and oxygen-generating systems. Because once they've left the point of application, then there is no residual left to select for any sort of resistance change at all. So use oxidizers and bleach. Let's reduce gastrointestinal disease and cross-infection through hygiene, because through the reductions in antibiotic use, that will limit antibiotic resistance. And if there's a take-home message today that you do take home, when you listen to the news, when you listen to the media, beware. The harbingers of doom are always there, and a scare story all sells better than the 7:45 arrived on time. Thank you.
Dr. Gilbert, thank you very, very much for a really fascinating presentation. My thanks as well to Virox Technologies for their generous support. Thank you, Randy, and your team for your sponsorship. Thank you all for joining us. Again, Dr. Gilbert, thank you ever so much. This has been a delight. We'll talk to you again soon, and stay safe. Goodbye.